Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, Gary.
Hello, Guy. You've had a bit of a struggle getting your mic set up because you're in a different place, aren't you, today?
I'm in a different place. I'm at the home of sort of masterful recording. I've been recording with David Gilmour all afternoon. But everyone's busy in the studio, so no one wants to help me with my humble laptop up here at the top of the house.
You'd think the Gilmours would have, you know, some super satellite, like Starstruck or something.
They've just got their own satellite, you'd think, yeah.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, no, it's very bad at the moment because it's gone around the dark side of the moon.
And then what's going to happen after we've done this pod?
I think maybe a spot of dinner.
Could keep the microphone running, of course, but... So we've got Duff on from Guns N' Roses, and I need to ask
and
you
so much more, and so much more. Sorry, yes, go on.
More than just Guns N' Roses. I mean, numerous bands, but have you got a tattoo?
No, I haven't. No. Should I have? No.
Well, you know, these guys, you know, like Duff, he's got loads of them, right? So there's a whole kind of, you know, people who have tattoos.
Have you got ink? You don't say have you got tattoos. You say have you got ink, don't you? Isn't that what
I mean, you live
say?
In Brighton. You need one to go through the border, don't you?
I did live in Brighton and one did. No, it's a funny thing. Apparently tattoos are something that happen at the turn of the century, every century. Tattoos and scarification becomes a thing. And then it sort of fades out.
Because of the millennium.
Yeah. Oh, yes. But listen, I just want to make one little point about something. When we had Steve Howe on, I'm so annoyed that I didn't ask the one question that has been bugging me, and I bet it's been bugging you as well, Gary, for over 50 years. He played guitar on the song that we know as Grocer Jack, but is called Excerpt from a Teenage Opera.
Right. Keith West.
What? What? Teenage Opera? What is the Teenage Opera?
Yeah, it was never written, was it? It was never written.
No.
Who wrote it? Now you've got to, you've said it. Now you've got to tell us who wrote it.
And any of our listeners who have info on the Teenage Opera that never was.
Well, he was the lead singer in Tomorrow, wasn't he? Keith West.
That's right. Yes, he was.
And that's why Steve ended up playing guitar on that. I'm just quickly doing what everyone does and Googling it. And so, yeah, it was created by a record producer called Mark Wirtz. And the first song released from it was Excerpt from a Teenage Opera, Grocer Jack, recorded by Keith West in 1967. And the album was not released until 1996.
Oh, so there was an album. Ah.
Yeah, obviously he caught up with everything and did it in the end. I don't know how long it ran for. It was in Southfield Park Arts Centre, Bracknell, on the 11th of August.
Right. Didn't storm the Tonys with that then.
I think it was of his time.
Sorry, back to Duff.
Back to tats, right? I just wanted to say, because my dad had tattoos. My dad had an anchor and a lizard on his arm, which I was extraordinarily fascinated with. So for me, it just represented the other generation. But you know what's interesting about Duff? Is not only does he have tattoos, which I'm sure are very symbolic as well. I noticed on a picture of him on the internet that he's got Prince's sign scrawled onto his base, and he's got LAMF. As in the Heartbreakers.
Heartbreakers album, yeah.
You know, these symbols seem to... It's all very postmodern, I think I'm saying. You know, this kind of... None of us were born during the beginning of rock and roll. We are all of these things. We are LAMF. We are Prince. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's very true. Well, yeah, no, you're true. Because I like his... I mean, I'm sure we'll get to it. I like his thing of his three absolute touchstones are Prince, Iggy, and Lemmy.
Yeah, Lemmy, yeah. Not you.
No.
Lemmy, yeah. But Iggy's on the new album, on his new solo album, which we will be talking about, Lighthouse.
We will be talking about that, yeah. And in fact, he went on tour. This time we're going to talk because it was our mutual friend, toured with him, with Iggy, last year.
Matt Clifford.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Should we get him on?
Welcome to the Rock On Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
That's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
That caused a big problem in the band, actually. I was having too much fun.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
Well, I get the feeling that us three should go for a pint. That's what I think.
I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock Haunters podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Keep on rocking!
Thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me. Oh. I had a long conversation with Matt Clifford a couple of weeks ago.
Yes. We were just going to bring him up. Yeah.
Yeah. In London. Well, I was in London about 3-4 weeks ago, maybe now. We had a lovely dinner with Matt and his lady. We ended up talking for 20 minutes about you guys.
We love Matt. He's such a great guy. So just for the listeners, you know, Matt Clifford plays keyboards with the Rolling Stones and has done for a long time. Plus French horn or something like that. You know?
I mean, you know, he's amazing. And I got to know Matt from, I got to do a record with Iggy Pop a year and a half ago. And we did the record. And then Iggy wanted to play some shows with myself and Chad Smith, who played drums on that record from the Chili Peppers, and Andrew Watt. And we needed keys. And Andrew was just then working with the Stones, beginning that work with that new record.
I wondered if that was the connection. Is that how Andrew got introduced to the Stones, because of Matt being in Iggy's band?
No. It was, he had already started, I think at that point, started working with the Stones. So that's how he knew Matt. So Matt got thrown into our Iggy band, and it was epic. Matt is an epic guy, and really actually was an epic band.
No, it was an epic band. In fact, I've got a message here from Matt Duff saying, ask him about the video I did for his 60th birthday reel.
Oh my. Yeah. You know his videos he puts out like on Instagram and stuff, right?
Yeah, amazing professional.
Yeah.
And then the humor of Matt is, okay, everybody outside there listening, you know, it's wonderful to get a new friend. You know, myself, I just turned 60. You get a friend that you think like, he's from another part of the world. You guys kind of do the same thing. Never met. Then you get to do this Iggy Pop thing together. And then you realize his humor is maybe some of the most brilliant. So my new friend, Matt Clifford, made the most ridiculous video for me. I don't know how to explain it. It's video. We'd have to play it, you know. But witty, hilarious, and.
And how, let's just talk about Iggy, though, because he's on your new album as well. But what was it like being with him? I mean, you know, we grew up, I'm just a little bit older than you. We grew up with Iggy as our, you know, it's a hero, especially in the, you know, it really came into focus for us with David Bowie and that whole period.
Yes.
How was that?
You know, with me, you know, he's a waypoint for me, for sure.
I know. He's one of your three lodestones, isn't he?
Really. Yeah. So, I mean, I could tell you stories that Iggy Pop got me through a bad mushroom trip. I went to an Iggy show way too high on mushrooms, thinking I was going to have to go to the hospital. Freaking out. And then Iggy went on, and this is 1979. I'm like 14 years old. And I just watched, Iggy the whole, just tripping way too much on psychedelics. But he brought me down, and I was already a big Iggy fan, but then I was like, he means more to me. He's a waypoint for me in my life. You know, I got to do a record with him in 1990, I guess it was.
Sorry. Brick by Brick, wasn't it? Yeah.
And that was super epic. I was still drinking. So this time it was kind of a little redo. And to be able to put together a band for him. And he let us pick the set list. Like, playing songs you guys want to play. So it was like, this is the soundtrack to my life. You know, where do you start? But as you said, Iggy, for me, you know, there's kind of, I mean, there's a lot more than three, but for me, there's Prince, there's Lemmy, and there's Iggy as sort of the truth tellers, you know.
I noticed that there's a picture of you on the internet when you've got on your guitar, you've got Prince's symbol. And then you've got LAMF from the Heartbreakers out written on your jacket. And I was just saying to Guy earlier before you came on that we are a kind of postmodern rock generation. You know, those early guys, you know, like Stones, I mean, they were just beginning the whole thing, you know. But
yeah.
And it's great, I think, to admit your influences and say, you know, all of these made me.
Yeah. I mean, you could throw a Killing Joke in there, you know.
No, absolutely. Yeah.
Because that's a really interesting thing about you, Duff, because you are from the, which is quite rare in America, from literally, it was first wave and a lot of British punk that was really doing it for you, wasn't it?
I got in early into punk rock. I mean, I am the last of eight kids. Looking for something of your very own was the directive in life because there was too many kids, right? You wanted something of your own, anything, a pair of shoes to your own. But I started seeing these punk rock flyers on the, you know, telephone poles. And that was 1977, a guy with a mohawk, you know, and we formed a band and I got introduced to all these. They were much older than me. They were like 18, you know, where I was 12 or 13.
Yeah. Were they British groups in there? Did any British group come out?
Sure. So we had, you know, Export Records. So we go to the record store. That's what you do. You would go to the record store. They'd be playing stuff. So it was, of course, the Pistols and the Ramones. And, oh, geez, but the Stiff Little Fingers and the Damned's first record. Mm. UK Sub, a lot of the Ruts, you know. I could keep going. Seattle was so close to, is so close to Vancouver, BC. And back then, the B in the BC was what's much more pronounced. So a lot of English bands could go to Vancouver and play where they couldn't maybe get U.S. visas. They could go to Vancouver. And that's 100 miles from Seattle. So I got to see the Professionals with Steve Jones and Paul Cook. You know, they couldn't get into the state.
Oh, wow.
Right. Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
This is really interesting because obviously there's such a massive scene that happened in Seattle.
Yeah.
And you were really involved in that. But that may have been because geographically it was easier for Seattle kids to go to Vancouver and see bands. So they saw more British bands. A bit like the kids who lived in Liverpool in the 60s were getting records coming off the boats from America. So
That's
why we get the Beatles.
I've always had a thing, Duff. Sorry, I just want to show, I just wondered if you'd agree with this. I've always thought that Seattle, and a lot of it could just be the weather, that Seattle is very much America's Manchester.
I can get with that. I get that, yeah. And you know, there's a direct flight from Seattle to Manchester.
Oh, there you
these
go.
These days. Yeah.
If the Smiths were going to be American, or if, say, New Order were going to be American, they'd come from Seattle.
Definitely Northwest vibe. Yeah, for sure. When I was a youngster there playing music in Seattle, I live in Seattle now. I mean, but it does rain more, and especially back then it did rain more. And you would go in garages and basements and play. That's what you do all day. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like later on with what they call grunge, you know, which is just great, you know, whatever, rock music. I mean,
pumpkin minor chords, right?
Yeah, I put in some Sabbath, you know, minor stuff in there, you know, if you're Soundgarden. And, you know, there were such great bands coming out of Seattle.
Yeah.
Ridiculous. I mean, what's really got to be ridiculous? Like this, Soundgarden's great. Alice in Chains is great. Nirvana's amazing. Pearl Jam, Mark Lanegan, you know, Screaming Treat, all of that. Like, how does this all come out of one place? But my theory is back then, and probably like Manchester, because it does rain in the UK, you know, but you would rehearse in basements, the strings would get damp. Everything was always kind of damp. And that kind of low, sludgy, you know, sound is kind of easier to get. It's easier
to
get.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
I mean, punk influence, though, obviously, you mentioned the Ramones, but obviously the British punk scene, the London punk scene was hugely different in feeling. But, you know, you could trace all of it back, not just to Iggy, but to the New York Dolls.
Yeah.
And that seems something that also was so connected to Guns N' Roses, to the sort of glam metal scene. There were two branches, if you like. One went towards the Sex Pistols and one went to the sort of glam metal.
Yeah.
Were they in your life?
That LAMF record by Johnny Thunders was a guiding force for me. Mm-hmm. Like, that's how you write a song, right? So maybe more Generation X and Johnny Thunders and the Heartbreakers, maybe more of an influence. If you look at our, like, fashion, Yeah, if you look at what we're wearing, like boots outside of the jeans, who did that? Generation X did that.
That's interesting. Yeah, because we had Tony on the other week, Tony James, the other week. Yeah. And it's an interesting thing because, as I said, because Generation X was like, had a slightly more glamorous vision of punk than the other London bands, you see.
And what songs and what tones, what drum tones and guitar tones. And so, you know, Guns N' Roses is a very interesting band about, if you talk about influences, because it was so wide and we all liked each other's music and bring in like Fear, and everybody loved Fear and Axl bring it. You got to check out Nazareth, the deep cuts, you know? So, you guys, I'm really, really sorry. I'm just going to take you with me. There's somebody at my door.
Take us with you. Take us with you.
I think it might. And it's Slash, everybody. All right.
I'm there. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, brother. Okay. I'm in Maui.
Yeah. Is this your place in Maui, Duff? You have a place there?
This is.
Wow, man.
This is.
That's the dream this is right the morning. There.
You know, Duff, it's funny you mentioned Generation X because, beautiful. Wow. Yeah, we're just seeing, getting a glimpse of out of the window, Maui. Generation X, they went on and influenced you guys. But at the same time, Billy was such an influence on the whole New Romantic scene that I came out of. You know, in fact, he was hanging out with us as well. So I love the way in all youth culture, things just seem to split and go in two directions, but have come from the same roots.
A great splinter. Like the New Romantic scene was such a cool splinter, and you could say, okay, well, the influences there were the Dolls.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean,
Generation X, Prince.
Absolutely, yeah.
When New Romantic hit and Bow Wow Wow and all that stuff too, it was such a great like second wave. Mm-hmm. Killing Joke in there as well. It was a great second wave that was very strong. It was the moving on from punk rock. The 15, 16-year-olds getting to be 18 and 19. And kind of exploring what was more out there. So our influences were everywhere. I mean, from Nazareth to the Ramones to the Pistols to Generation X to Motorhead.
You had the guy from Nazareth, didn't you, Manny?
Yeah.
Was kind of first tried to produce Appetite.
It would have been interesting. It didn't happen. But those Nazareth records are so that really nice, dry.
Yeah.
Everything's super clear and loud.
This is pre-ACDC as well, pre-ACDC.
Yeah, totally, totally. So it's like the ACDC Rick Rubin sound, dare I say, also?
Yeah. But before the Rick Rubin sound,
Before Rick Rubin, yeah.
Exactly. It seems that you didn't know whether to be a drummer, a guitarist, or a bass player at one point, though.
Yeah, I was, you know, kicking around.
You play drums for someone and then guitar for someone else?
Yeah.
And those early.
I grew up that way, again, being from the big family. The house next door, they had it also 8 kids. There was a drum kit there. All the older kids played.
Is that common? I mean, was it some sort of really old Catholic neighborhood or something? Just these houses of 8 kids? I mean, that's like the 18th century or something.
It was totally an Irish Catholic.
Right.
My dad was a fireman. Next door neighbor was the mortician. The guy next to him was the cop. You know, so it was that the church was on top of the hill.
It's like a Bruce Springsteen lyric. Isn't
right.
It?
No, yeah. So, yeah, a lot of kids. And that's how I got my nickname, Duff, because in 1964, in our neighborhood, on our block, there was, I think, 5 boys born. And they named them all Michael. All the moms and dads, I guess, everybody could see that was going to be a problem in a couple of years. Because back then, you just call the kids would go play. You know, we were feral.
Michael.
Yeah. Too many Michaels. So we all got nicknames and mine stuck.
Well, there it is.
This Seattle scene, though, because just sort of doing a bit of research on you, Duff, there's just so many bands and you seem to be bouncing around between all of them. And was it the Farts that you sort of, that was the beginning of it all kind of, you know, which ended up as 10 Minute Warning? Was that the sort of the beginning of the proper stuff for you?
I mean, probably proper. Yeah. I played a bunch of shows. I played my first show ever playing was playing bass in the band called The Veins. And we opened for Black Flag, which was a big, huge thing. Wow.
That's a good start, isn't it? That must have been a big deal.
That was a great start. Yeah. It was for us, that was a big gig. Now, looking back, there's probably 80 people there. But it was a for us was a huge gig. And I played around the Farts. You're right. Was probably the first. And I went to drums for the Farts. That was first kind of like we played more than Vancouver, BC. We went down to San Francisco, went to LA and played shows. So at this point, I'm probably about 17 and it's starting to happen. And then 10 Minute Warning turned into this other band where we got Greg Gilmore in to play drums, much better than me. He's like the Bill Bruford type of drummer. Oh, he went on to Mother Love Bone.
Right.
And I went to guitar with this guy, Paul Soldier, who actually Stone and I are producing a record, joint producing a record with Paul Soldier. Look for this. He was like Seattle's Johnny Thunders, who never got his due. Right. So Stone and I are helping him do this record right now. So
great.
Where was I at? 10 Minute Warning, yeah, was proper. It was like kind of slated to go to another level. But the problem was heroin befell that band. And that really, the heroin influenced me. Like, I got to get out of Seattle because everybody around me is doing heroin. It's 1983 and 84. And I was kind of like the last man standing. So that's when I decided to go someplace. And I realized when I got to Hollywood, is where I went, that you can't outrun drugs. It's everywhere. Mm. And I get to Hollywood and it's like, okay. Oh yeah, I guess it's here too. I was so fortunate in finding Slash and Steven first to an ad in a paper.
What did the ad say?
So there was a little newspaper back then, it's called Recycler. And you could buy cars and washer and dryer, hire services, whatever. And there was like musicians wanted section of the thing. And it said influences bass player needed. Aerosmith, Fear, early Alice Cooper, and the guy's name was Slash. So I thought he was like a old punker. I'm doing quotation marks, old, because you were only 19 at that point. Old punker like me wanted to figure out what's next. 10 Minute Warning had started to do that. We have slowed things down. It was maybe the first of that slow Seattle movement. So I'm like, okay, this is up. I'll call this guy. And I talked to him on the phone, called him from a payphone, of course. And to this day, still very soft spoken. And he's like, yeah, man. He sounded so cool. And he's like, my band, Rodker. Rodker, that's a strange name for a band. Welcome. So I went and met him and Steven at a deli, at Cantridge Deli. And I figured out the name was called Road Crew, not Rodker. But it was just like his name and the influence were great for me. Early Alice Cooper, Fear, and Aerosmith. Motorhead might have been on there.
Right, right. Because what's happening in LA then? Because it's hair, right? It's
no.
It's, or is there like this to the punk scene?
You mean people like Motley Crue and Poison? Yeah. That
you're
sort
right.
Of scene?
Yes. I'm going back in my memory banks now. There was a bunch of hair. You're right. And the pointy guitars. You know, that kind of thing, which didn't speak to me whatsoever. Yeah. I had no entry into that. I liked Judas Priest, Love AC/DC, anything, you know, quality that had balls to it. I was like, I dig, but what I moved down into in Hollywood at that point was a little light and a little technical too.
The best description I've heard of the guitar playing that period is ostentatious.
Just a lot.
Exactly. That kind of.
You know, there was the handles on the guitar. I didn't know what to.
Did you feel that Slash had the same sensibility as you?
That night that we met at the deli, we went to his house, his mom's house, into the basement. We were just talking, and he picked up his acoustic guitar and started playing. And it did that sense of blues and rawness. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, this is his approach to music, which is not ostentatious guitar playing at all.
There's elements of Keith in there as well, isn't there? I mean, it's
yeah.
Although the funny thing is, sorry, just to jump in, is that the first notes I heard, like on MTV or whatever, of Guns N' Roses, and something that a lot of people would have heard, would have been that guitar at Sweet Child of Mine, right?
Yeah,
and that's almost Fripp.
Yeah, yeah.
No, totally. Yes, you know. Absolutely. It's out, man. And how that would intro such a sweet little three-chord song, you know.
That does not set you up for the band that is coming down the road.
You know, who was the singer of Road Crew?
I was the singer of Road Crew for the very short-lived Road Crew that there was. Right, like, right, well, right. Can you sing too? I'm like, I mean, sort of, you know. But that only lasted, like, I swear, 5 or 6 rehearsals. And Izzy, you know, the story's been told a million times, but Izzy moved across the street from me and said, hey, I'm got spammed with this singer. His name's Axel. And they had another guitar player, a different drummer. And we did a couple gigs. I said, okay, I'll check it out. And Axel was like, first time I saw him sing at the rehearsal place, I'm like, uh-oh, what the fuck is this? You know, he had like 2 voices coming out.
Unbelievable.
Such a lovely guy, like really mellow about it too. I'm like, how the hell did you do that? Oh, it's nothing. You know, I don't know. Yeah.
Because they were coming from the more kind of, you know, LA Guns and Hollywood Rose. There was a bit more of a glam feel about what they were doing.
I mean, Izzy was Thunder's number 2, you know. He looked like Johnny Thunders. He played, you know. He was definitely more Rolling Stones. I don't know how much he was into the glam thing as much as he wanted to be the new Stones.
Right.
You know, whatever he did. But there was a look. I mean, the new romantic look influenced us, you know.
Well, it was big in L.A. It was so big in L.A., that whole K-rock scene.
Yeah. A mix with that and, like, the macabre, what was that scene? You know, Christian Death and all those bands.
The goth scene,
right. There was a bunch of fashion influences that definitely dotted around in your... And, you know, truthfully, we didn't have any fucking money. So, like, the pair of pants you had better be the ones you like, because that's what you had, you know?
You were leather, weren't you? You were a leather pants guy.
I had a pair of black Levi's and the buttons went out in it. So I fixed it with a yellow shoelace. I don't know where I found it. And I tried to yellow shoelace coming out. And these were the pants I wore. I got leather much later on. I couldn't afford leather. Leather pants. Yeah.
Do you know, Duff, you said earlier that, you know, this story's been told 1,000 times. The truth is, these stories are our Omaha Beach. You know, these are our D-Day stories, you know.
Right.
You'll forever tell them because they thrill everybody every time we hear. Because, you know, a band as big as Guns N' Roses and all the bands and people we have on this show, but as bands as big as you, came from guys with no money who just happened to bump into each other.
Yeah.
You know, and found the perfect balance.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
How is it working? Because you have, you know, very bravely, you've just got in your car or whatever, and you've left Seattle and you've gone to LA. I'm assuming, you got some sort of muck job or something? How are you eating?
I got a job as a cook right away, driving into LA. I was a cook in Seattle. I was a baker. I worked at restaurants. So I had a resume. I pulled into a steakhouse because I needed money now.
Mm-mm.
I had stopped in San Francisco on my way down. I had $360, but I stopped in San Francisco for more days than I would have liked to. Hung out with some friends, spent $160 of my dollars. So I had $200 when I got to LA. So I needed, that wouldn't get me an apartment. So I worked at the restaurant until my first paycheck. I had to live in my car. So that was 2 weeks of in the car, you know, washing secretly at the restaurant, pretending like you got a place to live. But I got an apartment, got the job, got the apartment. And then, you know, I met those guys pretty early on. The cooking job was a seasonal thing. So I had the job for like 2.5 months and I had to get something in Hollywood. I needed a new job. And so I, like everybody in Hollywood, you worked phone sales.
Right.
Which
right.
turned into like I was delivering things and I don't know what it was. And I didn't want to know. I just saw my old boss. I saw him. He's a Hungarian. I saw him in Budapest in July. The first time since I worked for him.
Oh, wow. How come?
Well, I'd written about him in my book. He had reached out. How do I put this? And they were connected. You know, this is early 80s. They were connected.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
And so I didn't really ask many questions. It was $150 a week for me, you know. And they liked me. They trusted me. And I worked there for a year and a half. And it got me through that first part of Guns N' Roses until we got a record deal and got an advance. And I didn't have to work a day job, at least for the next 6 months, you know. So yeah. I left my job there, but I was actually kind of sheepish to leave that job. I don't want to say scared, but maybe I was a little scared.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you'd only been rehearsing for a few days and then you suddenly play the Troubadour, which is one of those gigs that everybody was at. Oh, Guy, I have to tell Duff that I was at that Pistols gig with the Clash. Have I not told you this, Guy? You know, I was there at the Screen on the Green when the Clash and the Buzzcocks supported the Pistols in 1976.
You were there.
I was there. But how many people were there at the Troubadour when you played?
Oh, no, absolutely, yeah.
Millions, right?
There was three. There was actually three. Yeah, we played a gig in Seattle. We did this little tour that ill-fated, but it was great for our band because it really bonded us. We hitchhiked in Seattle and played our first gig, and we were opening for the Fastbacks, an old band I was in. We had to use their gear because our car broke down in Bakersfield. It's a long story, but we made it to Seattle. And everybody claims they were at that first show in Seattle. Everybody in Seattle.
Oh, right.
Now, the truth is, it was just the three people from the Fastbacks, the band we were opening for, who watched us. And maybe one other person. So I'm like, I don't know if you could have, all these people could have been at that show. I must have, lights were strong. I couldn't see y'all. Yeah, I get it. I understand here.
How did the writing come together between all of you?
Isn't that funny? We knew the moment that the five of us were in a room, like the first three chords, it was like, oh, we finally all found each other. You know, this is the band. This is the one you're going to go. Especially for me, I'd been in so many bands and those guys too. This is the one. And songwriting, as I found out over the last bunch of years, 40 something years, is a gift that comes to you out of nowhere. And to do it as a band, to write as a band, doesn't always work.
Yeah.
And in this band, what we had was somebody would have a part, somebody would have an idea, somebody would have a vocal. And we would start writing around that. And somebody would have a piece. We weren't afraid to, that's not a good one. It wasn't offensive. You know, if you brought something in, like, how about this? Yeah, that ain't it. You know, we weren't afraid to tell each other that wasn't it. But we also weren't afraid to latch on to something that somebody had. So that's why you see, like, publishing split evenly through that period, because if you held a knife to my neck, I couldn't tell you who wrote which part, song. Right. You know, it was so interconnected. Yeah. And it was, we really knew, like as we were writing those songs, that we were learning how to write songs. And nobody worked harder at it than us. Two-a-day rehearsals. We were so into it, you know. So we just lived and breathed the whole thing.
Yeah, you did. I mean, then it went on tour forever.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's the musicianship that really shines in the band. And that first album, I mean, it just goes on to break all the records and be the most successful debut album of all time. You come from punk and you talk about punk a lot, but the musicianship is so strong.
To me, I mean, if I'm playing bass, I learned from Paul Simonon,
yeah,
who started, you know, right. like, and Prince. You know, if you put those two things together, you're going to have a groove and you're going to have a real sense of bass style. You know, I didn't rip off anything from Simonon, but just that feel of his things, slinky and cool and rolling, and Prince's precision and groove.
Yeah, you're right, because Prince was so super minimal on the bass, wasn't he?
And,
yeah.
you know, he wasn't playing big fills when, the, you know, when him as the drummer was doing a fill, he wouldn't do a bass fill over it. And Stephen and I really worked on that groove thing. And not to overplay, but be impactful as an engine, you know? And that was really interesting to me at that point. Still is.
Yeah, the album didn't take off at first, though, did it? It took a little while to start up. I mean, was there a sense of, like, maybe this isn't going to work, or?
Not to us. I don't think there was any doubt with us. I think, the record took a while. We just kept out on the road. There was rumor that, the record company was going to pull us off the road and start a new record. But somebody at the record company saw promise in us and kept us out there. A couple tours really put us over the edge. You know, the Aerosmith tour at the end when we released Sweet Child of Mine and everything went haywire, you know, from that point on. So we were out there for a while. It wasn't an overnight success, you know. But back then, bands could stay out there and we weren't the first band for a record to hit a year later, you know.
You know, I was touring America a lot then, and then I was staying and working in LA. And I remember when you guys happened, it just seemed so obvious. It just seemed so, because there was just this hair and this super shredding stuff. And it's like, fuck, a rock and roll band. I mean, this is so obvious, you know. Thank Christ, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we just thought rock and roll was the thing to do, you know, and nothing else.
Although the thing is with Axl is, you know, he could also write an incredible power ballad. And that's sort of, it wasn't just rock and roll. There was that ability to play the piano, come in with great songs as well. That pushed you into a much wider genre, if you like.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he always had this vision, you know, like even when we were eating Top Ramen, like if we were lucky, we were eating Top Ramen. He had just always had this vision. It's going to be huge. You know, it's really, I see it. Okay. You know, he's a good guy to go into, a great guy to go into the trenches with, you know, like a singer as a leader is great to have.
Yeah.
He did some work with Jonesy in the end, Steve Jones and John Taylor on the Neurotic Outsiders. Was that during the Guns N' Roses period, or had you already sort of left the band by then?
I hadn't left the band yet, no, but I'd gotten sober and the band was somewhat dormant. At that point, there was substance issues going on. I'd gotten sober. The thing with getting sober for me, I didn't know if I was going to be able to play music again. I thought that part was over.
Wow.
Yeah, I just thought I wouldn't be able to get up. Like, how do you do this without Octal or two? You know, I don't know if I can do that. You been there?
I know what you're saying. Yeah.
So there was Steve Jones, one of the heroes.
What a sound.
I learned to play guitar, listen to Jones.
Sober a long time. So that must have been, you know, that was probably very helpful in itself, wasn't it?
Yes. He is sober. He called me. I'm like, wow, Steve Jones is calling me. And you want to play this gig? And I told him, I said, Steve, I don't know if I can do this, you know. And he goes, oh, you're going to be fine. I held on to those words for years.
Wow.
You know, coming from Steve Jones, you're going to be fine. The funny thing is, because I learned to play guitar, listen to Jonesy and Johnny Thunders, kind of, you know, that style. And so when I got into play with Steve and John and Matt Sorum, I'm like, I'm playing guitar. I'm like, how am I going to hide my influence? Which is, you're standing right there. And he recognized it. It's like, all right. Steve has become such a great friend in my life, my daughters, you know, he's an uncle to my daughters. Everybody should have Steve Jones in their life.
Well, going back to that show I saw, I don't think I've told you before about that show, Guy, but you know, when Steve walks on stage and he's got Guitar Hero written on his amp and his legs are kind of sprayed out, you know, and that sound was so big. I mean, that just Absolutely. Yeah. You know, because I'd just seen The Clash and the Buzzcocks. That blew everybody away. Steve's guitar sound. And the mix on those records is so good, on those Sex Pistols records. You used Bill Price, didn't you, who engineered the Pistols. Oh, you used him to mix Use Your Illusion, right?
That's correct. Yes.
How was that?
Yes. Well, it was great. You know, we tried to get Bill Price to did some amazing things. That sound, that monstrous, huge sound. You didn't get Bill Price to do anything, you know, or back in that time.
You had Bob Clearmountain do it originally, didn't you? Which I can't kind of connect Bob Clearmountain with
Guns N' Roses. Mixing, right. You're talking about mixing, right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was a little too much. And so Bill Price came in and kind of did it right. And Steve Lillywhite, tried to get him. But for Appetite, we were like, the wish list was just all the great records we that we love. Like, we get that guy. Mutt Lange was our record budget. Wasn't a big record budget. It was a new band record budget. And Mutt Lange was more to walk in the studio than we had. So we're like, okay, I guess we're out there.
Yeah, I mean, he took about 3 years to do Pyromania, didn't he? Or whatever. Yeah. I'm sure it's something like that.
Right.
But what about John Taylor? How was that to work with? I mean, a Durrani.
That's when I really learned, like, John Taylor is an amazing bass player.
Yeah, he's great.
And all that stuff. I guess I didn't put much thought to it. I don't know if John could play all that cool shit on Duran Duran, you know? And it's all him. It's a, you know, the moment we started playing, I'm like, oh, okay, that was all John playing that stuff. Killer guy, just a wonderful guy, great bass player, fun guy to go out and do gigs and travel with. And, you know, we'd play gigs and you'd look out. We wouldn't play huge plays, play like little theaters and stuff. But me and Jonesy's side of the stage would be the raucous, you know, like in the punkers. And then John's side of the stage, there was a gig in Germany. Our side of the stage smelled like beer and sweat, you know, and spit. And John's side smelled like perfume because it was all the Duranny girls were lined up. Like, well, this is a much nicer place to be over here, John. Yeah,
that's brilliant. But about that time when you were doing that, you got, you know, I guess this is probably a lot to do with getting sober, but you got so busy, didn't you, with everything? When then, because then there's your, you start making your own albums, you start doing all your writing.
Yeah,
as a fellow bass player, you wrote financial columns, which I couldn't find anywhere. I just love the idea of a bass player writing financial columns. It's just so brilliant. I mean, obviously, Geezer Butler is very good on leveraged buyouts. And, you know, there's not much Les Claypool doesn't know about derivatives. No, I'm just so impressed.
Wow. I didn't know these things.
I'm joking.
I know you are. I know you are.
Sorry.
Well, I got busy. I guess when you get sober, too, I was waiting to get sober. I was like, I knew there was so much more potential in me than an alcohol. You know, when you're chasing your high 24/7, you've got no time to do anything else. And it's a waste of a human life, you know, and I was wasting mine. So when I was able to get sober and I found the key to stay sober that day, you know, the next day, after 2 years, I met Susan, who's my wife for now, we've been together 27 years.
Congratulations.
And that kind of like put me in a place where like, okay, I got to excel, you know, and she would really push me. And we had our first child and she had it. I was there just in the room. We had a child. No. She had the child for sure. But I, you know, got into school, went to business school but I went to a Jesuit school. The business school was it. So you write a whole ton of Jesuit in the school I went to, a lot of writing. And that pushed me into I got a call from Playboy, from Tim Moore, who was the editor. Would you write this financial weekly column for Playboy.com? And things were starting to come unhinged in America. It was like 2007.
Oh, right.
Early 2008 when things, 2008. So I felt it was my responsibility to kind of, in plain language, lead people through this thing, the fears and what was going on. And I was writing for the Seattle Weekly at that time. I got a gig there writing a weekly column, writing for ESPN. At one point, I had three columns a week. So it was like, I'd be on the road and I still have a BlackBerry because of that.
Wow.
I would write passages. I'd write columns on my BlackBerry. I'd write passages for my book on my BlackBerry. Just so got adept at writing there and think, being able to think and not think about tapping the keys. That I can't move over to an iPhone.
Wow.
Is it tricky if any of that becomes political for you when you're in a band like Guns N' Roses, you know, with a diverse audience?
Writing?
Well, in times of these culture wars, you know, and you're writing and you're doing financial writing, is it difficult that you have to be careful not to be too political and take sides, or are you quite open about that?
I've been open about it. Listen, man, a lot of that culture war and political, from what I see, because I travel so much and I do little off the beaten track trips all the time on tour. I'll go to Owensboro, Kentucky, to go see the Ohio River and stay a night and go to places to eat and whatever. I'll ride a motorcycle through the South and go to really off the grid places. And I'm just a guy on a motorcycle. And what I've been doing this for a long time. I do it in Europe, I do it in America. And, you know, I've never stopped someplace and got a coffee. Somebody said, oh, you one of them libtards? You know, nobody's polite society, and most of us are polite society. Don't want to talk about that stuff. How you doing? How's the trip going?
Yeah.
Blah, blah. I ask about town. I think, you know, social media has really been a killer as far as like information coming to people and people being able to spout out their opinions. I read a lot. I travel a lot. I've read a lot and traveled a lot for a long time. It's yucky right now, to be sure. But I don't pay that much attention to it because I see what I see. And maybe I choose to see what I see, how I see it. You know, when I write songs, like the tenderness songs, and I write forgiveness for my new record, Lighthouse, they're quasi-political. But it's more just like, hey, stop all this bullshit and let's move on together.
Yeah. Your album, we should talk about it. I mean, with your relationship with your wife as well seems to come into this record. But, you know, you've been in loads of bands. Bands are a place where you never feel, you don't ever feel vulnerable, really. Maybe you do within the group, but not to the outside. You all hide and you're a gang, right? You're stronger together. As soon as you start doing solo records, the most vulnerable time, I would say, for you is the day that record gets released, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I guess vulnerable is a good word. If you let that creep into your thing, because I still got the hard shell of being in a band, I have to rely on other people when it's my solo music because I don't have my band. I'm used to like bouncing stuff off of other people. When you do your own music, it's you and your producer, especially in the case of this last record I did, Lighthouse. It was during COVID. So it was really, I played a lot of the stuff, drums and all that stuff included.
Wow.
So I really had nobody to bounce it off of. Like, I think this is good. You know, this is just add some more backing vocals. Let's go. I have time. But yeah, I don't know if I like to read, and I haven't done it for a long time, reviews. I haven't done it since back in the Guns days. My manager will send me something like that he thinks is right on, like somebody nails the
But just lyrically, you're opening yourself up, aren't you, lyrically?
Lyrically, absolutely. I mean, I tried to write a song for my wife. It's so hard to in a 3.5 minute song, really kind of tell a story of that deep thing we have. She's such an easy thing to write for. It's such an easy subject. I could write every song about her, but that would be, of course, like absurd. But I try to do that. But when you do that and you sing about your relationship with your wife, you know, you can get like, are people going to take the piss out of me for doing this? But some point, you just got to like not give a shit too.
There's some nice big sort of some of the sort of religious imagery and stuff as well. And the kind of, you know, that comes up. I saw God on 10th Street and also and in Holy Water about the altars and killing lots of men. All that stuff. That's kind of what are you getting rid of there?
You know, sometimes it's just a lyric, man, that comes. And I don't think it's any deep-seated being made to go to sit, kneel, stand at the Catholic Church. None of that shit. Then, you know, I went to a Jesuit school. I studied theology for 2 years, you know, deeply, not because I wanted to, but it's a Jesuit school. You have to. And so I got, you know, like every subject there, I got into it. Like, I went, okay, I'm here to learn. I'm paying for it. What do you got? So I got to learn a lot about the study of God and religions. And so I think that creeps into my songwriting more than anything else. My knowledge of it, you know, I just read a bunch. Dan Jones, he's a great British history writer. Yeah, yeah. The Crusades, you know. I think reading about the Crusade, me reading books really influences my songwriting. You know, you read about the Crusades enough, you're going to talk, you're going to write a song about death and destruction in the cities and, you know, pushing the altars.
I guess a line can be drawn between the Crusades and a band on the road like Guns N' Roses. You know, I mean, you know, a bunch of guys traveling the world and trying to make it theirs.
Yeah, right. But we didn't eat people on our way. Right, you know, we didn't eat pagans on the way.
You know, you know. I mean, I love. There's a bunch of songs on here that I think are really great. I think Lighthouse is fantastic. Longfeather, I love
Longfeather. Yeah, which has that sort of behind the beat riff that I love. That kind of Beautiful Day kind of vibe, which I'm really Abe Laboriel Jr. Who just sounds amazing, and I've got to say Slash really pulls it out of the bag as well, doesn't he? His playing is beautiful on this.
That song Hope you're talking about with both those guys, that was a song I got these masters back. I'd made a record in 1996 at my house in LA, and that record got shelved. It was when Geffen got bought by the big Omni group, whatever it was. And a bunch of records got shelves. My God, shelf. The thing is, they kept the masters. I'm like, what are you doing? You know, like, give me my music back. My band made a lot of money for your record company. You're going to hold on the record and keep it from me. So they did until 2020. Wow. So we got, my manager got my masters back. I'd almost forgot about all this stuff. But there was this song on there. I listened to stuff, and the song Hope, which you hear, was Slash coming to my house, but me and Abe tracked a song. Slash came up a couple days later, just to visit, and we were down in my little studio and said, you want me to put something on this song? Well, sure. And I recorded him, and that his guitar lines on that song are so cool. So I re-sang it currently. I re-sang the song so my voice sounded the same on this whole Lighthouse record. But other than that, that's the track that we did in 1996. I just think the subject matter of hope really fit the Lighthouse record, and that's why I put it on there.
And you got Jerry Cottrell as well from the Alice in Chains, haven't you?
Yeah. He's my guy. We do a lot of stuff together, whether it's just playing on each other's demos or whatever. He's a trusted guy I can send. He's one guy I could send songs to, and he'll give me an honest opinion. And he won't spread it around, you know. And I've done the same with him. And for him to come in and play on the song, he's like, man, he heard that song. I sent it to him. He goes, hey, you want me to put some on this song? And I'm like, okay, Jerry would be crazy. So he's just got such a beautiful touch. And his guitar solos are always something iconic, you know? And I see him fight for those guitar solos. And it's really a pleasure to watch. And he's my good buddy, you know, which is, you know, I pinch myself, but my good buddies are some of the world's finest musicians, you know. And
well, also got to be said, that vocal delivery of Iggy.
Oh, the voice of God.
On that version of Lighthouse, that is something else, man.
Yeah. So that was when I was doing those Iggy shows, and he's like, you want me to do anything? You know, and he had heard Lighthouse, and he just sent us, like, him reading it. Yeah. I'm back in my studio. My studio, this place like of solace, like there's now just been me in there and my producer, Mark Davier. And we get this Iggy track and his voice on the little speakers, you know, we didn't put him up in the big speakers, the little speakers. It rattled the room, just his voice.
He's like Charlton Heston. Cecil B. DeMille would have loved him.
Yeah, no doubt, no doubt. And so we put that music around his reading of Lighthouse, and it was really such a nice way to end that record. Classic, like old school reprise.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Duff, am I allowed to ask if Guns N' Roses are going to do a new album?
You're allowed to ask whatever. I mean, there's things that have happened and more things to happen. So right. I think you'll see that question will be answered soon enough.
Yeah. And what about touring for you with this album?
And nothing's announced, so I don't know what to say, but I got the gigs. I'll be there in October.
Great.
I'll be in the UK.
We'd love to come and see you.
We'd love to come and see you. Duff, sorry, yes. I don't want to be annoying. Can I ask you a question? This is something so inconsequential and so unimportant and such. It's just one of those weird little things that has been stuck in my head for like the last 30 years, right? And it's just because I saw the video so much on TV. In the video for Patience, what is the significance of you taking your room service tray to the front desk?
Don't you get it, man? No. Gotta have a little patience. I don't know. It was it. We were.
He had no patience.
I think we had a hotel. The old Ambassador. We had like a place to like film. So I think we tried a bunch of different things, and that was one of them. I always wondered too. I'm like, is that going to really get across? I guess I'm probably not happy with my room service, and I'm bringing it down to the front desk, which you never do.
Exactly.
Where's my glass of red wine with my, you know, with my meal? I don't know. That's a great question. Nobody's asked me that question ever.
I'm not surprised by that at all.
I was on tour for forever at that point. And I just kept saying, and I'm a bass player staying in hotels like that. And I was just thinking, what's he got that I haven't? What am I missing here? Why is he doing that?
The thing is, at that point, we hadn't yet stayed at hotels like that.
Yeah, you didn't know if you had to take your own trays back.
No, but this was an aspirational video. This was aspirational. Duff, when Matt gets back from the Rolling Stones, and if you're in town and whatever, be great absolutely. To actually meet up.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Yeah, I'll be there in October. Maybe Matt will be there. We can get a meal of food or something.
Cool.
I think I'm playing the, from what I know, the Islington...
Yeah, Academy.
No, Assembly.
Assembly. I know.
You know that one? That theater?
Yeah. I actually played guitar in the Rich Kids for a stint, and we played that very gig, and it's fantastic.
It's a fantastic gig, right?
Yeah.
I've been there before. So, okay, guys. Well,
brilliant.
Thank you. I'm in Maui, my day's just starting.
Duh.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
It's dark here.
Cheers, guys.
All right, thank you for coming on, Duff. All the best.
Yeah, all the best. So great to have you.
Cheers, guys. Thanks for having me on. Bye.
Bye.
Hey, that was good. What a nice man.
Very nice man. Very well spoken. Very erudite. Really good.
Bookish. Bookish, I think you'd
say.
Bookish,
you could say, yeah.
Do you know what? I mean, it's extraordinary when... You know, people I know who have given up drink and cleaned up, how they then say, right, I'm going to do everything I would have done before. I'm going to do it all now. You know, I'm going to read every book. I'm going to be culture, see everything that I need to see. His kind of hunger for culture is really apparent.
Yeah. Yeah. Wish that had happened to me. But anyway.
No, come on. I really related to that bit that he gets away and he tries to go and see things while he's on tour.
Well, that's what we do.
We do, right?
You have a funny thing when we're on tour, because I still have this thing for the old days where I just get scared if I'm too far from the hotel. And you try and find whatever attraction or museum is as far away from the hotel as it's possible to get. It's a weird thing, that.
I know. And then I get terrified. But, so you're still at David Gilmour's house and you're probably going to enjoy some fine wine in a minute, aren't you? Well, David will, obviously.
It's his birthday, so...
Please wish him many happy returns.
I certainly will.
I'll see you next week, right?
Yeah, and it's... so it'll be good night from me.
It's good night from him.
Rockanteurs is produced by Gimme Sugar Productions for Warner Music Group UK.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.